Another rare flint smile.
Promise I'm not gonna tattle.
I think I'd kill my dad or Jimmy if I stayed there. The confession slipped out, but then I remembered who I was talking to and quickly backtracked. Not kill or fight, just...
I get it.
A different muscle worked in Flint's jaw, this one making it seem like he was having a hard time not laughing. That was okay. I wanted to laugh at me, too. Anyway, I'm renting the old ransom place. Block from your parents' place. Why I was making small talk with Nash Flint, I had no clue. It was this way when he came to the tavern as well, as if I'd do anything to prolong the contact.
I didn't see a moving truck.
Nash frowned like it was a personal affront that something had happened in town that he hadn't noticed. Didn't need one. I travel light. This was an understatement. I'd been so fired up to get out from under Dad and Jimmy's thumb that I'd packed everything I needed in a single car trip. Your mom's still there?
She went up to Portland after Dad died. I'm still there, though, so don't go egging the house.
Flint's frown slid into a rather disarming wink.
You gonna get Flora Ransom to sell you that pile of boards?
She was a friend of Mom's. Mom and Flora had both been waitresses at the old tavern way back when, and Flora'd always had a soft spot for me. Not Flora's fault the place fell into disrepair. Flint's face softened.
Your mother was a good woman. I should have offered my condolences sooner.
Good was stretching it a bit. But she'd tried hard, loved fiercely, and was missed every damn day by me. I nodded. Flint's radio crackled.
I'd better let you get on, then,
he said to me, moving away from the window.
Drive safe.
Always do. He chuckled at that as he walked away, but it was true. I'd left my reckless years behind long ago, even though Flint and my feverish dreams about him certainly threatened to bring that streak back to life. I tried not to think about Flint or my dreams as I made my way back up Butte to my family's place. On the outskirts of Incorporated Rainbow Cove, the family seat was a messy sprawl of acres of junk with a few trailers tossed in. My Uncle Gunnar had my grandparents' old house by the road. Then a long dirt drive led to my dad's house, and beyond that was Jimmy's trailer. A dilapidated sign near the turnoff read, Hank's Scrap Metal. Nominally, there was a rusty gate, but most of the time they were too lazy to bother with it. I pulled in front of Dad's place and grabbed the two bulging sacks I'd filled with leftovers from the weekend that wouldn't keep. Back in Portland, we'd donated our excess to charities. Here, we had the Hanks. Feeling guilty, I'd had Adam take some cheesecake to his mom's. Dad needed to lay off the sugar anyway. He came to the door, leaning on his cane, pair of beagles preceding him.
You're later than you said you'd be.
He wasn't mean about it. More resigned, as if he hadn't expected better from me. Sorry. Got pulled over by Flint for a busted brake light. I made my way into the house, which, as always, smelled of cigarillos, dust, and dog. I'd largely outgrown my asthma, or at least learned to manage it, but it was a wonder that my lungs didn't seize up every time I came here.
"Flint! That son of a bitch!"
Jimmy sneered from the old brown couch near the one working TV. It was stacked on top of two that didn't turn on anymore. "Hey, I was grateful for the heads up. Can you fix it for me?"
"Yeah, yeah."
Jimmy made a dismissive gesture that meant I'd have to prod him a good four more times before he actually did it.
"You watch yourself, Mason,"
Dad added.
"First it's a light. Then it's 5 miles over. Next he's harping on your license renewal. Always something."
"And never your fault." I sighed. "Same as always around here."
"Uncle Mason!"
The real reason I'd come, and the reason I even worried about food for this place, came barreling in from the kitchen and dining area. "Hi, Peanut!" I swept Lilac up into a hug. My niece was 7, and the spitting image of my brother, fine blonde hair, green eyes, and delicate features.
"Did you bring bread?"
Her voice was all hopeful.
"We're out."
"Of course." I rubbed her head. "You got peanut butter?"
"Of course."
Jimmy imitated my smoother speech. Lilac usually stayed with her mom, but Francine was off dancing in Coos Bay again. She'd turn back up eventually, but without my mom here, I worried about Lilac being fed and getting to the last week of school. And, unfortunately, if her teachers got concerned about her, it wouldn't be the first time Jimmy and Francine had landed on the radar of Child Protective Services. Thus far, they'd managed to scrape by with warnings, promising to work out their domestic squabbles peacefully and to stay clean and sober. But my heart beat faster at the thought of the state getting involved with our family again. We'd had cousins in and out of foster care, and it wasn't a fate I wanted for my Lilac. "You do your homework?" I ignored Jimmy and spoke directly to her.
"Yeah."
She shrugged. Miniature version of Jimmy when he put on a world-weary attitude.
"Math is hard."
"You can skip it."
Jimmy's tone said he was already bored by my presence.
"No, you can't."
"I'll help." I glared at Jimmy. "I'll do a load of laundry for you while I'm here if you round up your school clothes."
"You're a good wife."
Jimmy's tone was teasing, but there was a bite there.
"Watch it,"
Dad said before I could. "Your brother helps out, which is more than I can say for your lazy ass."
"Little ears."
I gestured at Lilac, but it was a losing battle, getting Jimmy or my dad to clean up their language.
"I'll put the food away."
Jimmy grabbed the bags from me and headed to the kitchen. Dad settled back into his recliner with a groan. He was the other reason I kept coming around. He might be cranky, but he was the only parent I had left. Mom's unexpected death had hit me hard, underscored all the times I could have eased her burdens, but hadn't, too wrapped up in my Portland life. I was determined not to repeat the same mistake with Dad, even if he lacked her quiet gratitude.
"Leg acting up?"
I asked.
"Just the weather."
He'd never admit to diabetic circulation issues. Mom would have pressed him into going to the doctor, but I didn't have her sort of leverage.
"And son, you really do have to keep an eye on Flint. He's got it out for us."
Not again with the conspiracy theories. "He gives me business at the tavern. That's all I care about." Dad shook his head.
"I don't trust him one lick. Not since Freddy."
Freddy was fool enough to listen to his friends and vandalize a police car. Burning it up wasn't Flint's doing. Dad shrugged. I wasn't winning this one.
"You didn't have to throw the book at him, that's all I'm saying."
"Uh-huh." I busied myself picking up the toys from the living room floor. This was just another reminder of why I couldn't go lusting after Flint. Dad might have grudgingly accepted me being gay, a shocker for sure, and at least partly Mom's doing. But he'd never tolerate Flint.
Nash. I worried about Mason getting rear-ended the whole way back to town. He might think I was being picky, but a broken brake light was no joke. I also didn't like the little electric jolt that had gone through my body when I'd seen it was him. Annoyance, for sure, but there was something else there, almost like I was happy to see him. And that just wouldn't do.
"Chief, I've got a call in about Vera Matthews." Marta's voice crackled over my car radio. "Her daughter thinks it's another heart attack. The EMTs are there and have a call into life flight. Can you secure the landing zone?"
"I'm on it." Our rural ambulance service was good, but we didn't have an ER or hospital, just an urgent care clinic. And we relied on the ambulance service plus life flight helicopters for real emergencies like this. I headed to the urgent care clinic, as that was where the helicopter usually landed. My job was to make sure that things went smoothly, no idiots getting in the way of the crew, and that the crew had everything in hand. I checked that the lights on the landing pad were on and waited for both the chopper and the ambulance. When the ambulance arrived, I headed over. Vera was a friend of my mother's, and I figured she might take some comfort from my presence. I greeted the two EMTs who were getting Vera ready for transfer to the chopper. "Vera, we're going to take good care of you, hear?" After my dad's series of strokes, the docs and nurses had told us to keep talking to him. I might not be much of a praying man, but I'd never seen the harm in a positive word. "She's stable," Derek told me. The young EMT was married to Candace, my junior officer. They were a nice couple, one of the few new families in town the last few years. We needed more like them, young folks looking to stay around rather than move on like so many of our kids did after graduation. The chopper arrived, and the EMTs got Vera transferred without incident. Derek and I stayed around a bit afterward, shooting the breeze about when the fishing would get good again, and whether it was a decent market to buy a house. It was past dark by the time I headed back to the station, what with a quick patrol of 101 and downtown and all. The car ahead of me was doing 6 miles over, and ordinarily I'd let it slide, but it was Jimmy Hank's beat-up Mustang, and I couldn't rule out another DUI for him. I flipped on the lights, but it took him 2 full blocks to decide to pull over. Typical. I waited for him to roll down the window, and then greeted him. "Evening, Hanks. You know why I pulled you over?" Jimmy muttered something unintelligible and less than charitable sounding, but his breath didn't reek of alcohol and his speech was unslurred when he finally raised his voice. "Nope. You were 6 miles over the limit."
"That ain't nothing."
He glared at me, really testing my decision to just give him a warning. "Think you can slow down around town?"
"I guess."
Another glare and some muttering.
"Heard you pulled over my brother today, too. Banner day for you, riding the Hanks boys."
I bristled at that. Jimmy Hanks had a way of pushing all my buttons, but I had long experience being calm and not letting my temper get the better of me. "You fix that brake light? We don't want him getting into an accident."
"Yeah, I fixed it."
He chomped down on the wad of gum in his mouth.
"You need to leave my brother alone."
For a split second, I wondered if Jimmy had some sort of psychic powers to read all the inappropriate thoughts I'd been having about Mason. Then I shook my head. "As long as he keeps his head down, he'll do fine. Nice establishment he's got going. Gainful employment's a good look."
"Hey now, I work,"
Jimmy almost spat. He bought junkers here and there, spent ages half-fixing them, and sold them on the cheap to people who always regretted it.
"I've been working longer than Mason. He was always spoiled. Soft."
I could not get into it with Jimmy, no matter the strange urge I had to defend Mason, who honestly was the hardest working Hanks I'd met. I might be skeptical, but the kid was trying to make something of himself, which was more than I could say for most of his family. "You go on now, Jimmy. Keep it under the limit." I ground out the words, hands fisting with the desire to wring his fool neck. There were lines I just didn't cross, and unfortunately for me, Mason Hanks was one of those lines. I didn't need a warning from Jimmy to see that. Didn't matter how nice Mason was, how hard-working, how hot. He wasn't for me.
5. Mason. I didn't know what to wear to the Chamber of Commerce meeting, but as soon as I saw Nash Flint inside the Rainbow Cove Visitor Center, I knew I'd picked wrong. He looked me up and down like he'd never seen a dude wear a peach before. It was one of the few shirts with buttons that I owned, And Felipe, my ex, had always said it made me look expensive, for whatever that was worth. I paired it with khakis that I'd actually ironed. I wanted to make a good impression. Flint was, of course, wearing his uniform. He always commanded respect and made a great first impression, but then he'd been born a Flint, whereas the sight of a Hanks in dress clothes had to be raising more eyebrows than just Flint's. "Since when do you come to chamber meetings?" I grumbled at him. It was 7:30 in the morning, and I did not do mornings, unlike Flint, who was probably one of those guys who woke up at 5 just for the heck of it.
"Coffee's over there, sunshine."
Flint gestured to a table against the far wall of the visitor center, where someone had mercifully set out 2 large urns of coffee and a generous tray of pastries from Dolly's Donuts. They got a little sign advertising their generosity. I needed to find out how the tavern could donate next month.
"Mason, could you help me with my flipboard?"
Brock, my friend from Portland, who'd driven down to attend the meeting, approached me. He looked at Flint with undisguised interest, while Flint's eyes narrowed. Brock had an air of city about him. Dress shirt that probably cost more than my monthly rent to Flora, haircut that required careful application of product, hipster glasses and skinny pants that showed off his Pilates and paleo slim frame.
"Sure."
Even though I was desperate for the coffee, I followed Brock out to his car, a foreign make that Jimmy would undoubtedly salivate over, but all I knew was that it was so shiny it made me nervous to ride in it. By the time I helped him lug in his stuff, Flint had already grabbed himself a coffee and a seat near the front. The coffee was undoubtedly black. The man didn't seem to have a single sweet tooth. For all the times I'd served him at the tavern, it was odd how little I knew about his partialities, other than a preference for red meat. I tried to tell myself that it was just my restaurateur's soul that had me wondering how to wow Flint and not the libido I kept trying to tamp down.
"That sheriff sexy?"
Brock asked in a low whisper. I groaned, keeping it soft.
"Adam told you that ridiculous nickname?"
"That he did." Brock sighed dramatically. "Forget my bonobo's shirt fetish. Next time I'm here, I'm wearing my I'd bottom you so hard t-shirt."
"He's straight."
There was a pause there, Mason. Brock's eyes sparkled.
"That was not a pause."
I distinctly heard a promising pause. "Can we all come together? Get your coffee and get a seat." Everly Atkins, who ran the visitor center and the chamber, clapped her hands once as she strode to the front of the room. "Mr. Watley Lewis, you can come up here." Brock followed her, tossing a look over his shoulder that said we weren't done talking about Flint. But we totally were. I was not going to encourage this crush of Brock's, nor was I owning up to any such thing of my own, no matter how much I wished I could fill in that promising pause with some concrete information. My hallway encounter with Flint had done nothing but confuse me for over a week now. He'd been in for food since then, always polite but distant, and I didn't think I was imagining the relief in his eyes when someone else had to wait on him. I grabbed a coffee and doctored it to my preferred light tan and highly sweetened consistency. I took a plain donut, to be nice, but I was already dreaming up what baked goods we could bring to one of these meetings. I'd never been much of a line cook, but I did love to bake, and doing the breads and dessert specials for the tavern was a point of pride for me. Everly handed around the minutes. Like Flint, she had to be a morning person, scheduling these things so darn early and looking all put together in a sweater set embroidered with seashells and matching skirt. She'd gone to school with my mother, but they hadn't been friends. My mom dropped out to have Freddie, while Everly snagged a business degree and an insurance salesman husband who ensured that she lived in the newer part of town with an ocean view and beach access. She hadn't been into the tavern, and had been more than a little skeptical of our plans in our prior meetings, but I wasn't giving up hope for her backing quite yet. We'd gotten the state grant, which had been step one in our plan, and we'd been at prior chamber meetings trying to drum up support for the next stage of our goals. She went over the old business first, of which the only interesting item was the ongoing discussion of whether Rainbow Cove needed a festival. Other local towns do hugely popular festivals. There's the Cranberry Fest, the Softshell Crab Fest, and ones devoted to sandcastles and kite-flying and local beers. Everly's blonde bob swayed as she gestured with her hands. It's time for us to get on the map. I raised my hand. Yes, Mason? Her tone was the same as every teacher's I'd had in the Rainbow Cove school system. She'd already decided she wouldn't like what I had to say. Coos Bay did a Pride Fest last year, and further north, Lincoln City does one, too. We could... We'll get to your ideas for us later, okay? She made a dismissive wave of her hand. But first, I wanted to brainstorm. What are we famous for?
The smell coming off Moosehead Lake.
Ralph, who owned the bait shack, cackled.
The old haunted mill.
Adam's mother, Patsy, spoke up. My guests always like that story. Frankly, Patsy's guests at the B&B liked whatever stories Patsy told. Her chatty nature was as much a reason why people returned as her breakfast quiches.
See?
Everly beamed. That's the kind of thing we could use. A spooky fall festival, anyone? And be thinking about ideas for later in the year, too. The next 20 minutes were spent reviewing other festival options and going over other old business, like the scholarship fund and a shoe drive for foster kids. All good works, but I was eager to get to our part of the agenda. Flint, of course, had plenty to say about the policing of said festivals, which got the issue tabled until the next meeting. Officer Buzzkill. That's what we're famous for. Finally, Everly made her way down the bulleted list to Brock's name. God, I hope this worked and people listened. The dream that four of us had hatched together in his Pearl District loft had been so perfect a year ago. But now, even with the grant and the business launching, long-term success seemed more tenuous than ever.
Sorry I'm late.
Curtis came rushing in, sawdust raining down from his hair as he took the empty seat next to Flint.
Lost track of time, but I didn't want to miss the grand Make Rainbow Cove Gayer plan. That is still on the agenda, right?
I glared at him. He, of all people, should be taking this seriously. LGBTQ tourism is huge money, I piped up, and tourists love to spend cash on unique art, including the overpriced tree stumps you sell.
Well, by all means, bring on the gay money.
Curtis made a go-ahead gesture to Brock. As Everly introduced Brock and gave background to the agenda item for those who hadn't been at prior meetings, Brock set up his large flipboard on the easel he'd brought with him. He smiled, adjusted his glasses, and began talking. Now, as some of you know, the Rainbow Tavern received a grant through the state. Part of why I'm here today is to discuss more businesses applying for funds. My development group is particularly interested in seeing more remodeling and new businesses opening or expanding, particularly if we can do it in a unified fashion.
Can you break that down into something I might have a chance of catching on to?
Ralph asked, leaning forward. If the town embraces the rainbow theme, and the Chamber of Commerce and businesses go in together on ads in some of the largest gay publications, that would be a big positive for my group to make a substantial investment in the area. Brock continued in MBA speak, albeit slower now. He means they're thinking about buying the old Sandview Resort. I explained for him, referencing the beachfront hotel that had gone bankrupt a decade ago, taking a lot of jobs and tourists with it. The news sent an excited murmur through the group of business owners, exactly the way I'd hoped it would. He unveiled a series of drawings showing a renovated Sandview, complete with pastel colors and depictions of happy tourists. The Chamber of Commerce's support was integral to Brock's investors committing to the project, but the City Council and other permitting agencies would also need to be involved going forward. And we're investigating whether the area could sustain a golf course and a spa. Another set of drawings, this time accompanied by tourism stats, some of which looked dire when compared to other areas on the coast. But where I saw economic flatlining, Brock saw opportunity. Curtis made a scoffing noise that ended abruptly. Flint must have kicked him or something because he didn't pipe up again. I sent Flint a grateful look, but he didn't meet my eyes.
"I do like the sound of a spa," Patsy chimed in, obviously well prepared by Adam to be on board with all this. "That could mean guests who linger in town a bit longer, spread their cash around."
"And fish."
Ralph tugged on his ball cap. I'd lived in Rainbow Cove most of my life and had never seen the man without a cap advertising his business.
"Do golfers fish?"
"I'm sure they do." Brock smiled broadly. "Now, the next step is going back to my investment group with support from local organizations for the purchase, the Chamber included. Can I get a vote on that?" The motion of support carried easily, as Brock had predicted. Few business owners would vote against the resort being profitable again, but the next part was likely to be more controversial. "The investors would love to see a united front. The Rainbow Tavern is going to sponsor ads in a number of gay-friendly publications, and if you're interested in being listed in the ads with them, I have a form for you." Brock gave the room a winning smile before sending a clipboard around. "If you'd like a rainbow decal to put on your store door or window, I have some of those as well, and local services can put up the rainbow or a pink triangle, like here at the Visitor Center, or at City Hall, even." I wasn't surprised to see Flint send the clipboard and sticker pad right on by, but I was a bit disappointed, maybe.
"I'll take one."
Ralph looked up as the clipboard reached him. He was seriously one of the last allies I would have expected.
"All money's green to me."
"That's the spirit."
Patsy signed her name with a flourish. The B&B was already planning some package deals with us for a room and dinner.
"Participation is, of course, optional."
Should have known that Everly would have to get another word in. She sighed, before making a motion to get an update on progress with the resort and the ad campaign at the next meeting, which I supposed was the best we could hope for.
"I know we're running behind schedule."
She fixed a glare right at me.
"But Chief Flint has been nice enough to come talk to us about the recent rise in vandalism."
"That's right."
Flint stood. I knew firsthand how his voice could go hard and cold, but his usual speaking voice was just right for reassuring people, all deep and soothing.
"There's nothing to get alarmed about. We have noticed the rise in graffiti and property damage, but we're doing increased patrols of our businesses."
He went on to explain about some of the specific cases, and I started squirming in my seat. I swore I could feel Everly's eyes on me, and she wasn't the only one zeroing in on my space. When Flint said that he didn't have a particular suspect, two shop owners actually swiveled their heads so they could look at me, like they had to verify that, yes, there was a Hanks in their midst. And I knew everyone was thinking about Freddy and his friends and their penchant for marking shit up in their teens. They'd done worse as adults. They'd had the bright idea of trying to steal the logbook from the front seat of one of the police cruisers, thinking they could erase a bust for one of Freddy's buddies. Somehow their prank had gone sideways, and the car ended up on fire. Freddy got a fast conviction and a trip to the pen for his stupidity, My family got another reason to hate Flint, and the police department and the town got more fuel to stoke their mistrust of the Hanks family.
When did all the vandalism start?
The jewelry store owner, couldn't remember his name, spoke up.
How do we know this isn't someone upset at the direction the town is taking? New businesses and such.
He ended with a pointed look at me.
There's no evidence of that.
Flint's voice was calming, but my back muscles still tensed.
It's probably some bored kids. School's out and there aren't enough jobs. We'll keep an eye out.
We all will, Everly added. It's important to report any suspicious activity right away. I nodded along with everyone else. It felt weird to agree to neighborhood watch-type activities. I could almost hear my dad's scorn and skepticism, knew how he'd roll his eyes at the caution being taken and say that Flint and the business owners were making a big deal out of nothing. By the time the meeting was adjourned, I was still off-kilter, torn between the voices of my past and the pressures of my present. I had a hard time returning Brock's smile. That went well. He gathered up his materials.
We're still on for you coming up to Portland end of next month to help me with the next round of convincing the investors about the resort, right? I think you'll add the right dash of local color.
We're on, I said, even though I didn't necessarily agree that I was the best one to represent the town. Everly had far more experience, Patsy far more charm, and anyone else far more credibility.
Do you need a ride back to the tavern or your place?
Brock asked as we lugged his stuff to the car. He'd spent the night, so we'd ridden to the meeting together.
I'm behind schedule for making it back to Portland in time for my afternoon meeting.
Typical Brock. He had a 5-hour drive ahead of him, and, of course, he had something vital waiting for him at the other end. He'd probably be on business calls on his hands-free device the whole way home, too. I'm good. I can walk back. The visitor center was at the far southern edge of town, right off of Highway 101, and next to the town sign, a giant wood monstrosity carved by Curtis, with a rainbow and leaping fish and ocean waves all competing for real estate. It'd be a bit of a hike, but I didn't need to slow Brock down.
It's going to rain.
Flint's voice startled me. I hadn't realized he'd approached us. His frown was as dour as the skies above us.
I'll give you a ride.
Perfect,
Brock said before I could reply. I'll just be on my way. He leaned in to give me a hug that lingered a bit too long, entirely for Flint's benefit, I was sure. You don't need to give me a ride, I said to Flint after Brock got in his car and started the engine. I don't mind a little rain.
Come on.
Flint jerked his thumb in the direction of his jeep. Bossy, bossy man. I opened my mouth to protest again, but then Flint smiled, eyes crinkling. And I was a goner.
I won't even make you ride in the back. This time.
6. Nash. I wasn't sure why I'd offered Mason a ride. Being neighborly wasn't exactly my strong suit. I just liked to do the right thing. And I guess that not making him walk in the rain counted as the right thing. But my motives weren't entirely heroic. I hadn't enjoyed seeing Mason with that city boy with the double last name and designer duds. Their hugs and touches and little teases all said there was a history between them. And I hated that it made my fists clench and back tighten. Jealousy had never been part of my personality, not even with Steve. And I had no claim on Mason Hanks, none at all. Still, my tone was sharper than it needed to be as I unlocked the jeep. Your friend in town long? Brock, I'm surprised you didn't note the strange car in town and his exact arrival time. Mason laughed as he settled his long legs in my seldom-used passenger seat. He came down last night, too busy for a long visit, and I think one night on my couch is his maximum. Book him at Patsy's next time. The leap in my pulse and new lightness to my voice was purely coincidental. I was not relieved to learn that Mason had slept alone. I thought about that, but we wanted to catch up. You guys know each other a long time, then? Mason chuckled like he'd figured me out. Are you asking if we dated? Suddenly curious about my love life? I reminded myself that I'd known Mason long before he had any business having a love life. The first few fat raindrops hit my windshield before I got my voice level enough to answer. Nope. I think you're lying. And Brock and I tried it on like forever ago, but we're too similar in some ways to work as a couple. Better off friends. That's how we started, anyway. He was friends with my ex. Ex moved on. Brock stuck around. You have a lot of these exes? I asked before I could stop myself. Ha, huh. I knew you were curious. And nope, Philippe was the main guy. Dated some others, but nothing lasted. How about you? How about me what? I bristled. Had he discovered some rumors about Steve? And if not, why on earth did my lips feel loose, like I was dying to tell someone about how it felt, him leaving? Exes. Why haven't I heard about you hooking up with someone? I'm too old for hookups, and my job comes first. I'd given the answer before, but it sounded awfully hollow right then. The rain picked up, and I flipped on the wipers, heart beating too fast, Mason's question slicing too deep. You haven't always been older than dirt? Come on. What about when you were younger? Have a girlfriend? Boyfriend? I thumped my hand against the steering wheel, suddenly noticing the traffic on 101 was barely crawling. I welcomed the distraction and hit my radio button. Marta, what the heck is with traffic on the highway? We're practically at a standstill.
Yes, sir, Chief. I was just about to message you.
Marta's voice crackled over the speaker.
There's a hay truck that's lost part of its load about 3 miles out of town. Sheriff's office and the highway patrol are on it, but it may be a while before things get moving again.
Jurisdiction was a pain in my backside. But however much I wanted to go investigate, I knew when to hang back and let the county sheriff and highway patrol handle things. You let them know that we're ready and willing to help if needed. It may be a few before I get back into the office, though.
That's fine. Over and out.
Marta signed off, leaving me alone with Mason and his pesky questions, and a line of cars that wasn't moving. Did I piss you off? Mason leaned forward in his seat. I didn't mean to. It's just, I saw how you looked at me that night at the tavern. That night when you came in with Curtis.
I know what night you meant. I ground out. And my personal life is just that, personal. No one in town wants the police chief to air his private business. And I'm not about to start just because you want to go on a fishing expedition.
I'm not the gossiping type. Mason sounded wounded. And I'm not asking you to take out advertising with the tavern or anything. Just asking you as a man, one you pushed into a wall, whether you're in disguise. Because as much as I don't want to upset you, I want to know. For me, not the world.
For you, huh?
Warmth crept up the back of my neck. I wasn't supposed to like hearing that. Not one bit. And yet my body felt strangely overheated at his confession.
For me, Mason said softly.
And a tendril of longing licked up my spine. Lord, but I'd been right. He was trouble. So much trouble.
It's irrelevant, I said firmly. That night was a mistake. I was out of line.
Oh, I think it's highly relevant.
Mason's laugh was warm and filled my drafty jeep. However, his next words chilled me but good.
You know we're having Pride Night on Saturday.
You're what?
I tried to will the cars in front of us to move.
Pride Night. We're going to do it once a month or maybe bi-weekly depending on turnout. We're gay-friendly all the time, but for Pride Night,
There will be special music and an emphasis on meeting new people.
You're turning into a hookup joint? I wrapped my sarcasm around me as tight as an undersized sweater.
A gathering spot for the local queer community. You should come. Dip your toes in the water.
I'm not dipping anything in anything. My voice was far too loud for the enclosed space. And this is what I mean by not relevant. It doesn't matter what I'm into. I can't be seen at any bar's happy hour. Not yours, not Rowdy's, not anywhere. No one in town wants to see their police chief out for a good time.
You're wrong.
Mason's voice was low and gentle to my loud.
People really wouldn't care, Flint. And you're not your dad. You don't need to keep to a 1950s ideal of policing. You're a real guy, not some mythic fantasy figure.
Curtis had said similar to me, 100 times at least, and so had Steve, and I was sick of it. You don't know what it's like to be me, okay? So don't go telling me about how easy things are.
Tell me.
Mason didn't back down in the face of my anger. Instead, leaning forward more, voice insistent.
Tell me what it's like to be you.
Tiring. So very goddamn tiring. No one, not even Curtis, had asked me that before. You want to know what it's like to be me on any given Saturday night? Okay, I'll tell you. 2 years ago, when the Jensen teens wrapped their car around a tree on Mill Peak Road, I was the one who had to tell Mrs. Jensen that her kids would never come home. There's not a day goes by that I don't remember the look in her eyes. Another week, some out-of-town teenagers had a party at their folks' vacation place, and I've 15 drunken kids and their angry folks to deal with. Some summer weeks, it seems we can't have Saturday without someone blowing some body part off with fireworks on the beach. And we can't have a weekend without at least one domestic dispute call. Every single Saturday night, that's what I'm thinking. How can I keep my town safe? Not how can I get lucky. I want to know how I can do my job better so I never have to knock on another door like that again.
That's hard.
Mason reached over, patted my leg. It was a friendly gesture, but one people almost never tried with me. I felt the warmth of his palm clear through to the bone.
Sounds pretty damn lonely, actually.
It's not lonely. I'm never truly alone. I had no idea why this was spewing out after years of keeping it all in. I wake up and I start going through the list of who needs me, who needs taken care of. I worry about Vera Matthews's daughter, all alone while Vera's recovering and Eugene. I worry about that stoplight up at Lakeview that always wants to go out. I worry about Dolly's son going off the wagon again. I'm never alone, not with worries like those.
That's not the same as having friends. People who care about you. People who can ease that burden of being you.
It's not a burden, it's a privilege. That was something my dad had always said, and I believed it with every fiber of my being. It's a privilege to serve my community. And an obligation. I'm not trying to hold myself up as some kind of hero. I'm just trying to hold it together, period.
But what if you didn't have to? Mason pressed. Not every minute. What if you got to take a load off? Let go of the ridiculous standards you seem to have for yourself? You could come to Pride Night. Prove to yourself that the sky won't fall if you let yourself enjoy something.
I want to enjoy you. The thought was there before I could call it back. I hadn't sparred with someone like this since God knew when. Nor could I remember the last time I'd vomited words like that. Finally, mercifully, traffic started moving again, and we came to the turnoff for First Street that would let me bypass the mess on 101. Am I dropping you at the tavern or your place?
Mason sighed, and I didn't think I was imagining the disappointment there. Tavern?
We've got to get ready for lunch. You coming in later to eat? That's probably not a good idea, I admitted as I turned onto Montana, heading past the square and city hall. Further down the block was the tavern, and I pulled into their lot. It wasn't right to get a small thrill at the idea of seeing Mason again later. Wasn't right how much I'd already come to enjoy the meals he served me. You have to eat sometime. And okay, so you won't tell me about your personal life, but tell me this. If you could add one item to our menu, what would it be? Oh, I don't know. I eat what's in front of me. Mason made a frustrated noise. Consider this a request for help. You were right about the plain iced tea. What else would customers such as you like to eat? It's the wrong time of year, but you can't go wrong with a good beef stew. That'd go nice with that bread of yours, I allowed. Or maybe do a pie as a special one day. Strawberries and rhubarb are in season now. My mom always used to make that in June. Folks raved about it. Mason smiled like I'd handed him the biggest trout out of the river. Come to lunch tomorrow. Maybe I'll surprise you. Of that, I had no doubt, but I wasn't sure that was a good thing. But before I could tell him no, he was out of the car, giving me a little wave. Thanks for the ride, Chief. Nash. Call me Nash. The offer was on my tongue, but he was already out of earshot, which was for the best. Other than Curtis and a couple other folks who had known me as a kid, I was Chief Flint around here now, and that was the way it was supposed to be. No idiotic mooning over what my name would sound like on Mason Hanks's lips.
7. Mason.
Tell me again why we're making beef stew in June.
Logan looked up from the carrots he was dicing. It was the day after the Chamber of Commerce meeting, and we were gathered for the morning prep work in the tavern's kitchen. I told you, we had a request.
Yeah, and every time you mention it, your neck turns red.
Logan's white chef's jacket contrasted with his designer jeans and shoes, a reminder that he'd always been more in step with Brock's crowd than mine.
It's Sheriff Sexy.
Adam was supposed to be peeling potatoes, but judging by the band-aids on his knuckles, this wasn't a task that Patsy had made him do often.
Come on, admit it. Flint made the barest mention of stew, and now you've got us browning meat and boiling potatoes. It's not like that.
I slapped the rye dough I was kneading harder. Little rye rolls shaped like knots would be perfect with the stew. We just haven't done a soup as the special yet.
Uh-huh.
Adam didn't even pretend to believe me. Lifelong best friend, and he couldn't give me the dignity of pretending I wasn't out to impress Flint. Luckily, Adam didn't have access to my phone, where I'd stored a good 2 dozen strawberry rhubarb recipes for consideration, or I'd never hear the end of it.
And you're sure I can't play with the seasonings? Chipotle or cheddar? Or maybe cranberry and beer?
Logan had moved on to celery, lightning fast flashes of night work.
Beer is cool.
I had to give Logan something to work with, but just keep it classic. You can do a twist on the sandwich for the other side of the specials board. If you'll have extra rye, I'm thinking an updated Reuben with roasted beets.
You've been awfully into vegetarian options lately,
Adam observed. Logan shrugged.
The vegan woodcarver guy is just as bad as Flint, always the exact same order. Maybe I want more choices for the vegetarian crowd.
Or maybe you've suddenly developed a taste for eccentric. Adam shook his head.
Trust Mason and me here. Curtis Hunt is nuts. Like carves outside shirtless in January nuts.
There's a rumor he recycles his piss to water his plants. I shared because I was totally on board with anything that distracted from Flint and my motives for making stew.
He once hacked up this big eagle he carved because one feather was off.
And with that, Adam was off to the races with Curtis stories to try to shock Logan, who'd never known that chainsaw carving was a thing until he came here. By lunchtime, I was confident that they'd forgotten about Flint, even if I hadn't, and kept stealing glances at the front door. But the lunch rush came and went. and no Flint. I was feeling ridiculous about the whole stew thing when the door chimed at almost 3, and in walked Flint, heading right to his usual table. His broad shoulders slumped as he sat, and he rubbed at his temples once he removed his sunglasses. I could practically feel the weariness rolling off him, so I grabbed an iced tea on my way to his table. Our conversation yesterday had changed how I saw him, made him more human, more of a man and less of an authority figure who, quite frankly, had scared me more than a little for years. I'd never thought of the burdens he must carry, but the anguish in his voice had been unmistakable. Nash Flint needed a friend in the worst way. I was probably the least suitable person in the world for the role, but I couldn't deny how much he'd been on my mind. I wanted to see more of the human, humble Flint I'd glimpsed yesterday. Long morning? I set the tea in front of him.
You could say that.
Flint took a long swig of his tea.
Saw your specials board on my way in. It's June.
The stew sold surprisingly well with the lunch crowd. My voice was just a tad more defensive than it needed to be.
I guess I'd better see for myself.
He gave me a tired smile that made my stomach do a weird little wobble.
Extra bread if you've got it, and I'll skip the salad today.
I'm on it.
And Mason.
He rubbed his face again.
Thanks.
That thank you warmed me as thoroughly as a bowl of Logan's stew, and I took more care than I needed to, dishing up Flint's lunch, giving him 2 rolls, plenty of butter, and a nice garnish on the stew.
You've got it bad.
Logan heckled me from across the kitchen where he was cleaning the grill.
Shut up.
Laughing, I shook my fist at him before taking the tray out to Flint. Here you go. Wanting to see his reaction to the bread and stew, I hung back after sliding the plate and bowl in front of him.
You're going to hover like that, you might as well take a seat.
Flint gestured at the empty chair in front of him.
You eat yet yourself?
You implying I'm too skinny? I had to work hard to keep the muscle on, but I was a far cry from the scrawny kid I used to be. After some dithering, I went ahead and slid into the chair. Flint was the only customer in the joint, and Adam was back having his food in the kitchen, so it wasn't like he could tease me.
Didn't say that.
Heat flared in the appraising look Flint gave me. He might not have admitted it in so many words, but Nash Flint was not straight. And I could tell myself all week that I didn't care one way or another, but I couldn't stop the little thrill at his purposeful glance.
Just...
He sighed, and it hit me how often Flint must eat alone. He lived alone in that big house, ate alone here, and I couldn't see him socializing much over meals with his junior officers and employees. I'm going to grab a soda. I rushed to the bar, made myself the fastest root beer ever, and was back in the chair before Flint could change his mind about inviting me to sit. So, your morning?
Tell me what's in the bread. It's not white flour, is it?
Flint asked like he really wanted to know, not simply like he was dodging my question. So I told him all about my sourdough starter and the rye flour I sourced from a Northwest mill. He asked good follow-up questions, and some of the tension in his shoulders and neck seemed to bleed away.
Soup's good. You guys got a good eye for seasoning. I'll give him that.
He's not my guy. I laughed, but I wasn't sure how much more obvious I could get. I'd been pretty shameless in telling him that Brock had slept on the couch. I was not supposed to care so much that Flint knew I was single. Logan's a great chef. I've known him since culinary school.
Why'd you end up in culinary school anyway?
Having demolished one roll, Flint started in on the second.
Because of my asthma.
I couldn't go for sports like my brothers, and I was limited in how much I could go running after them on our property. So I spent a lot of time with my mom in the kitchen.
My father never would have stood for that. Flint shook his head. Probably why I can barely boil water now.
My mom always said hungry people have to eat, and if you don't cook, you have to help clean. I'd much rather cook than clean. I left dish duty to the others. Not that Freddie and Jimmy had done a ton of dishes, but Mom had tried to instill some basic self-sufficiency in all of us. It was sad that Flint's dad hadn't seen a need for that.
Smart woman.
Flint took a big bite of stew.
And a damn fine waitress, too. Food in the old tavern wasn't anything like this, but the service was always top-notch.
Thanks, I said, both to the compliment on our food and to the nice memory of Mom. She had worked hard for the old owners when she wasn't working equally hard at home. After school, I'd hang out here when she had a shift and no one to babysit me. The old cook used to let me come watch some.
I remember Clinker McMahon well. He was a character.
Flint laughed. Man, I liked hearing him laugh, seeing him unwind even a small amount. But really, I owe a lot to Mrs. Mueller at the high school. Shop class was full my junior year, and they stuck me in home ec. She talked me into taking my love of food and trying for a scholarship, way out of this town. I remembered who I was talking to and added, "No offense. Obviously I love it here, but when you're 18 you just want something different, you know? Didn't you ever want to explore?" Flint shrugged.
"Not sure. Dad always painted the future as either the military or law enforcement. Easton picked the Marines. He always was gung-ho on getting to see the world. Me? I was happy to do my 4 years in Eugene, get my degree in criminal justice, and come on back home."
Flint's older brother, who'd died in Iraq, was a hazy memory in my childhood. He'd gotten some big medal, and his funeral had been a huge deal in town. "My mom cried when your brother died," I offered. There might be no love lost between my family and the Flints, but from all accounts, Easton had been a stand-up man.
"Me too."
Flint's gaze got far away, and his mouth narrowed. Damn, I hadn't meant to wander into unhappy territory. I toyed with the tabletop flyer for Pride Night that I'd put by the condiments on each table. "They say you only live once."
"Mason."
Flint shook his head at me, but he smiled, which was exactly what I'd been after.
"Quit trying to drum up business for your deal. And just so you know, I texted Curtis, told him he should come out. Socialize."
"Come with him," I urged. The door jangled before Flint could reply, and I hopped up to greet the trio of customers who came in. "I'll be back," I said to Flint.
"See to your business."
He waved me away.
"And thanks for the company."
His words pleased me far more than they should have. It made my shoulders lift to know I'd been a good distraction for whatever bad morning Flint had had, even temporarily. I liked being a refuge of sorts for such a stoic man, but pride was a dangerous, dangerous emotion, every bit as stupid as the notion that Flint needed a friend. Even so, I couldn't stop myself from hoping he'd be back for more.
"Nash. I didn't tell Mason, but I had Saturday night off. Candace Holmes had the shift with Locklear backing her up if need be. I went home when Holmes came on duty and showered like I always did after a long shift. Then I went to stand in front of my closet. Like an idiot. Say I did want to go to this thing of Mason's. What the hell would I wear? On my disastrous last trip to Portland, I'd worn my usual off-duty wardrobe of a polo and Wranglers. The first guy I'd worked up the nerve enough to approach had called me Grandpa and laughed. Apparently I was officially near death by gay standards, and no longer prime hookup material. I'd lied, of course, when I told Mason that I didn't hook up. Over the years, I had very sporadically. Here and there, always away from Rainbow Cove. Even Coos Bay was a bit too close to home. Eugene was bigger, farther away, and the college town had a surprising quantity of guys okay with discreet encounters. But I hadn't been lying about being too old for all that now. Mason